University of Cambridge Graduate Diploma in Economics. Dr. Mark Hayes on Monetary Macroeconomics.
Lecture 7, Policy Effectiveness and Inflation Targeting. You'll recall that our ultimate purpose in these lectures is to understand the business cycle and what, if anything, policymakers can or should do about it. And we're approaching the question mainly from the perspective of the new consensus in macroeconomics, which aims to combine both classical and Keynesian insights. At the centre of the new consensus is the concept of a natural rate of output, natural rate of employment, unemployment, and the rate of interest, to which the economy always returns in the long run. And the contribution of the private sector to the business cycle is described by the term shocks. And as we noted in Lecture 1, if you can remember that far back, this use of language is significant. A shock denotes a random disturbance to or from a long-run equilibrium position. And the subtext is that the private sector will return to equilibrium if market forces are allowed to operate, and furthermore that the market system itself does not generate shocks. Shocks are exogenous, like a bumpy road, if you like, a fact of life. And last term we built a model, the ADAS model, which we used to discuss the effect of shocks as well as policy interventions in a structured kind of way. And the model allows us to distinguish between the short-run and long-run equilibrium positions. A shock moves the economy's short-run equilibrium away from the long-run position, but the economy is always in short-run equilibrium, and the model explains how the short-run position returns to the long-run. So the title of today's lecture is Policy Effectiveness and Inflation Targeting. And the conventional answer to the question we set ourselves at present is that the most policymakers can do is target inflation. And my aim today is to explain how we've reached that point and enable you to make sense of key documents such as the Bank of England's inflation report. Now, the word stabilise itself also is loaded, since it implies that the role of policy, meaning demand management, is solely to try and offset these exogenous shocks. By contrast, Keynes was less concerned with volatility than with chronic underemployment. The consensus model provides no role for demand management in the long run, with one concession to which we'll come at the end, so that free competition and supply side reforms are the only prescriptions of the consensus for reducing the rate of underemployment in the long run. Now, the new classical school goes even further and argues against stabilisation altogether, even in a narrow, short-term sense. In a real business cycle model, fluctuations in Y and U are simply fluctuations in Y and U bar, Y bar and U bar. In other words, in the natural rates of output and unemployment. And since these are held to be equilibrium positions already, chosen by optimising agents, stabilisation actually reduces welfare, and therefore there is simply no role for policy. Stabilisation policy is damaging. It's not even ineffective. It's positively damaging. Now, the new consensus, to its credit, does not accept that, and as we've seen, it distinguishes between the short and the long run, where the short run equilibrium can diverge from the long run and represents a loss of welfare then. And the question remains whether stabilisation can be effective even if it is desirable. So it becomes a matter of practicalities rather than dogma, if you like. Now, there are three primary obstacles to stabilisation, and these are data measurement, forecast accuracy, and time lags. As this chart from Mankiw shows, even short-term forecasting is notoriously unreliable. And as we can see from this inflation report chart, the observation of shocks is not a trivial problem. Backcasting is almost as difficult as forecasting. Time lags are a problem because it takes time for a policymaker to make a decision in response to the observation of a shock, the so-called inside lag, and then for the decision to have its effect on the economy, the outside lag. And the classic example is getting the water temperature right in a shower, something you might have experienced if you live in college. This is compounded by the data and forecasting problems. Bad data may lead to wrong decisions, and bad forecasting may lead to misjudgments about the effect of decisions. So combined with time lags, that's a recipe for instability, as you may know if you've studied difference equations at all. In engineering terms, this is an exercise in control theory. We need to design a system where feedback leads to stability and not to oscillation or instability. Now, a good economic analogue of a typical engineering solution is what we call the automatic fiscal stabilisers, notably progressive taxes on corporate and personal income, including negative taxes in the form of benefits. And if we put those in, you can see that the fluctuations are smaller as a result of putting in the automatic stabilizers. The reason behind that in our model is what we captured this by introducing the tax coefficient, little t. So here's our Keynesian cross, which you remember well, no doubt. And the effect of putting in the little t is to reduce the impact of a change in autonomous expenditure, shown by the shift in the lines, to a smaller level because of the reduction in the multiplier. So if you plug that back into the model, what you get is a smaller response to a shock. And funnily enough, the Danish system of so-called flexicurity combines high income taxes with high unemployment benefits, so that redundancy is much less painful there than here or in the US. And our model suggests that high benefits will reduce temporary unemployment, in contrast with the current government's supply-side argument that high benefits discourage work and increase temporary unemployment. Although not much discussed, because they're not really that controversial, the automatic stabilisers represent an important contribution of fiscal policy. Thus, the main argument over fiscal policy is over the cyclically adjusted structural deficit. That is, the argument is whether there should be one. Even if the policy is to achieve structural balance over time, that objective remains consistent with periods of deficit and surplus in line with the cycle. But apart from that, fiscal policy plays little role in the new consensus because of the underlying concept of the natural rate. If the management of economic fluctuations is reduced to a question of volatility around a stable long-run equilibrium position, discretionary fiscal policy is for the most part an unsuitable instrument. The tax and spending decisions involve long inside time lags. And furthermore, there is in the new consensus no need for a structural fiscal deficit to finance public investment, since it simply crowds out private investment. So there is no macroeconomic case for it in terms of the maintenance of full employment. There was a slight wobble in that consensus on fiscal policy in 2008 and 2009 as the severity of the downturn became clear, but this was superseded with remarkable speed by the new austerity. Therefore, in the new consensus, it's best to understand stabilisation policy meaning simply monetary policy. So in order to understand the arguments that have led to the adoption of the current monetary policy of inflation targeting by more or less independent central banks, at this point I need to introduce another model. Now, last term we built up the ADAS model from its components. In the last lecture, we included an upward sloping aggregate supply curve as the bridge between the classical long-run vertical supply curve in PY space and the Keynesian short-run horizontal curve. I mentioned that we could easily make a connection between the sloping short-run aggregate supply curve in PY space and the Phillips curve in pi u space if we take inflation expectations as given. However, the aggregate demand curve, the AD curve, is drawn in PY space and it can't so easily be translated into pi y space, inflation output space. And that's a serious shortcoming, since the objective of policy is stated in terms of reducing the volatility of output and inflation, not the volatility of output and the price level. And of course, furthermore, we've not explained inflation expectations. They're just exogenous in the ADAS model. So the new model that I'm going to tell you about is called by Carlin and Soskis the three equation model, if you've got to that book, or by Mankiw, the DADDAS, DADAS, I shall call it, model, with five equations, as it happens, which he introduces only in his 2010 seventh edition, which is later than the one that the set text for the course. That contains an extra chapter 14, which is not included in the European edition, although the rest of the book is very much the same. I hope you got the note saying, warning you about this. The model's called dynamic because, as well as inflation rather than the price level, it introduces time into the model, which is essential if we're to try and explain inflation expectations. The ADAS model is purely a static model in which we compare different positions of equilibrium. Although the model implies that the price level changes over time to restore long-run equilibrium, there are no formal dynamics in that model. DADAS does provide an explicit dynamic mechanism, even if it is heavily simplified. And the other key difference between ADAS and DADAS is actually very significant. In ADAS, not only expected inflation, but the money supply are exogenous. If you like, and this comes back to the question you were asking, monetary policy is held to determine the money supply, and the interest rate is determined by ISLM, or in the IS star LM star version, it's the exchange rate that's determined. In DADAS, the exogenous money supply is replaced by a monetary policy rule, or it's sometimes called a central bank reaction function, And this means that the convergence to the long-run equilibrium natural rate, which still takes place, is no longer purely a matter of market forces. Now it requires the active intervention of the central bank in setting the interest rate. So this is an interesting and important admission that competition alone will not deliver full employment with price stability. And the origins of this theoretical approach lie with Knut Wicksell, the early 20th century Swedish economist, who held that a modern banking system generates instability to the extent that it allows the market rate of interest to diverge from the natural rate of interest. And the natural rate of interest is the money rate of interest consistent with the natural rate of output. And it's usually thought of as the real rate of interest consistent with the classical intertemporal equilibrium model, together with a premium for expected inflation, the Fisher effect. So more specifically, in Wicksell's thinking, if the market rate of interest diverges from the natural rate, inflation will increase or decrease. And the job of the central bank becomes to keep the market rate in line with the natural rate. But since the central bank can no more observe the natural real interest rate than it can the natural rates of output or employment, it has to infer these rates from the change in the rate of inflation. If inflation is rising above its target, interest rates should rise, and vice versa. Now, there's, of course, an element of self-fulfillment here. Policy success becomes defined as a stable rate of inflation, and whatever delivers that is natural. This makes political sense, since for governments, price stability is, on the whole, more important than full employment. And as Keynes put it in The Economic Consequences of a Peace, there is no subtler, no surer means of overthrowing the existing basis of society than to debauch the currency. Though actually he was quoting somebody called Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. So let's examine the DADAS model as set out by Mankiw. This looks very like what you've seen before. We'll end up with a diagram that looks and works pretty much just like the ADAS model, but with subtle differences, with pi rather than p on the vertical axis, and t subscripts on all the variables because it's dynamic. However, the mechanism of the model, and we'll come back to the diagram, is different, and it's based on five equations. Now, we'll look at these slowly, in more detail, in a few moments. But as an overview, the demand equation, or IS curve, and the Phillips curve, you're already familiar with, bearing in mind that the inverse relationship between output and unemployment allows us to write the Phillips curve in either pi u or pi y space, which is what we're doing here. The Fisher equation simply defines the real interest rate in the sense that we've been using it, as the money rate of interest less the expected rate of inflation. But the two new elements in this model are the monetary policy rule and the expectations equation. In this first step in dynamics, expectations are modelled as what is called adaptive, or backward-looking. In other words, tomorrow's inflation is expected to be the same as today's. And although the new classicals have been rather rude about this, in the name of rational expectations, adaptive expectations are not, in fact, so stupid under conditions of uncertainty. And as you'll see by the end of the lecture, adaptive and rational expectations give the same result when it comes to the question of the effectiveness of policy. Now, the monetary policy rule represents the rule the central bank follows in setting the interest rate. No central bank explicitly declares that it is following a fixed rule, but the so-called Taylor rule has been found to be a reasonable fit to the interest rate policy of the Federal Reserve, at any rate, over time. So let's look at these equations in more detail. Since we have five equations, we can expect to find five endogenous variables, only two of which, of course, inflation and output, appear in the final diagram, but that doesn't mean they're not there in the model. We class the other variables as either exogenous or parameters, together with one representing a distinctive feature of a dynamic system. That's a variable which is endogenous in one period and then becomes predetermined in the next. In this case, the previous period's inflation. And the exogenous variables include the metaphysical natural rate of output, Y bar, and the central bank's inflation target, pi star, as well as the demand and supply shocks to output or inflation, effectively. The parameters include the metaphysical natural real rate of interest, which we call rho, as well as various slope or behavioural coefficients. Okay. And the first equation for demand then shows that output can diverge from its natural rate for two reasons. The first is when the market, let me get this right, the market real interest rate, that's R, diverges from the natural real interest rate, rho, with the market interest rate and output inversely related. An output can also diverge in response to a demand shock, which we call epsilon. So this equation is essentially a version of a familiar IS curve in a slightly different format. The next equation, the Fisher equation, is really an identity rather than an equation. It's just a definition. The market real interest rate is defined as the observable money interest rate less the expected rate of inflation. So the market real interest rate is always an expectation. And note that the inflation expected at time t is the increase in the price level between times t and t plus 1. The third equation for inflation is the Phillips curve, again translated from pi u to pi y space. There are three elements here: the expected rate of inflation, which corresponds, if you like, to the idea of money neutrality. If inflation is fully anticipated, it has no real effect because all prices are adjusted in anticipation. The second element is familiar from the upward sloping short-run supply curve. And as I said, you can easily translate that from the ADAS into the DADAS model from PY to PIY space, given the first element, which is the expected rate of inflation. And the third element is the random shock to prices, which we label nu. And the equation basically states, in summary, that inflation will be as anticipated unless output diverges from the natural rate or if there's a shock. So now we come to our two new elements. The expectations equation could be very complicated indeed, but here we simply assume, as I said, that people expect inflation in the next period to be the same as it is in the current period. What I was going to say was that this is enough, this simple assumption about expectations, to bring dynamics into the system. This is basically the connection between one period and the next, is through the adaptive expectations assumption. Now, Carlin and Soskis, if you have a look at that book, they reduce the system to 3 equations from 5 by cutting out the money interest rate and substituting last period's inflation straight into the Phillips curve. So Mankiw's approach is actually better, since he makes explicit that the central bank controls only the money rate of interest, not directly the real rate. Which brings us to the completely new final equation, the monetary policy rule, for the nominal or money rate of interest. And this replaces the LM curve. As I've already mentioned, this is no longer a matter of competitive market forces. This rule represents the decision-making process of the central bank. To understand the equation, let's just begin by assuming that inflation is on target, so that pi equals pi star, and output is at its natural rate, y equals y bar, so that the final two terms on the right-hand side are zero. Then the rule states that the central bank should set the money rate of interest equal to the natural rate of interest plus the inflation rate, since inflation's on target by assumption. And that amounts to setting the money rate of interest at its natural rate, given the inflation target. And if you think back to the Phillips curve, if output is at its natural rate, inflation will remain constant, barring shocks. So the rule represents Wicksell's basic prescription. And starting from that equilibrium position, shocks can arise either to output or inflation. And you probably already can see that in a simultaneous system like this, an output shock can affect inflation and vice versa. The effect of the shock is not limited to a single equation. Thus, a shock of either kind will lead to a divergence of output and inflation from their natural rate and from the target, respectively. The monetary policy rule then tells the central bank to raise the money interest rate if inflation and output are above par, and vice versa. Now, an interesting thing about this rule is that it implies that the central bank should raise the real interest rate, since the inflation term appears twice, and its coefficient is effectively 1 plus theta pi. This makes sense, since the IS curve is obviously a matter of the market real rate of interest, so that output and inflation will only reduce in response to an increase in the money rate of interest to the extent that it increases by more than the increase in inflation. Now, the major difficulty for monetary policy is that while a demand shock leads to inflation and output moving together, a supply shock has them diverging in opposite directions. And the relative weight placed on the two different kinds of divergence then becomes important, and that's shown by theta pi and theta y. The degree to which the central bank is hawkish on inflation is reflected in the extent to which it raises the real interest rate at the cost of reducing output when inflation is above target. However, since inflation and output divergences are linked through the simultaneous system, in practice it makes sense for the central bank to respond to divergences in inflation alone, which are easier to observe. In the case of a demand shock, that will also tend to correct the output divergence because they're in the same direction. In the case of a supply shock, there's a conflict. But if the central bank succeeds in bringing inflation back to target, output will also return to its natural rate. So it is argued. And that is why stabilization policy, in a nutshell, becomes inflation targeting rather than inflation and output targeting. Now, this monetary policy rule is theoretical, but there is some evidence that central banks operate along these lines. The American economist John Taylor suggested that the Federal Reserve followed a rule with an implicit inflation target of 2% and equal weights on the divergences of inflation and output from par. And this is the chart, suggests a reasonable fit. Now, as with the ADAS model, we can reduce this system of five equations to a system of two, represented by the DAD and DAS curves. This diagram, as before, allows us to consider the qualitative shifts, or the qualitative effect of shifts in the curves. Remember that shifts represent changes in the exogenous variables, and importantly, also the predetermined variable, that is, last period's inflation. And because we now have an explicit dynamic mechanism linking the periods, simple as it may be, we can go further and quantify the changes if we assign numerical values to the various parameters of the system. And that technique is called calibration and derives from the real business cycle approach. Calibration allows us to construct something called an impulse response function, which tracks the changes in the short-run equilibrium values of the endogenous variables over time. You can think of it as a movie, really, recording the results of a sequence of DADAS diagrams, starting with a shock to a position of long-run equilibrium and tracing the convergence back to equilibrium. So let's do that. Let's consider the effect of a demand shock, epsilon, that lasts for five periods. First, we'll look at this in the same fashion as before, shifting the curves and telling the story graphically. So we start here in a familiar place. Short-run equilibrium corresponds with long-run equilibrium. We're in period T minus 1 and at point A. So note the subscripts on the curves. And inflation is where it is. We have a positive demand shock that shifts the aggregate demand curve to the right. We're in period T now, so we've moved in time. And output and inflation have also increased. Since we're at B, and output is greater than the natural rate, we expect inflation to rise further. But we've got adaptive expectations. Okay, but so that means that all that the expectations take into account is the inflation that's actually happened in time t. But the effect is in t plus 1 for the aggregate supply curve to move up, and we're at point C. And basically, we go on up the aggregate demand curve for another three periods. But in period five, or the fifth period, we have a change that the shock now disappears, so the aggregate demand curve slips back to where it was. Okay, but by assumption it was a temporary shock. So the economy now moves from point F to point G. So we're now below, output's now below the natural rate. Inflation is above, quite a long way above where it was to begin with. But again, you can now see, and I won't go put the situation, the model in reverse, but basically we come, but the process reverses, the aggregate supply curve starts to drop as inflation drops, and we end up back where we started at point A. So, having used the diagram to show the qualitative effects of the demand shock, we can then proceed to produce impulse response functions if we plug in specific values for the parameters of the equations. And these are the values used in these slides from Mankiw. So these are the calibration values, setting Y bar to 100, so and the inflation target and the natural real rate of interest at 2%, and using the Taylor rule. The demand shock is 1 percentage point of output, not shown, but this is then what you get. So the top chart is the demand shock. The effect on output is the bottom chart. Output increases by less than 1% because some of the extra demand is spent in raising inflation. Inflation then rises continuously while output is above the natural rate, if you recall from the diagram. Output then falls gradually as inflation rises from period T to T plus 4, and then falls back sharply in T plus 5 as the shock ceases and goes below par. That means that inflation falls and the system returns to equilibrium. So you can see we're telling a different kind of story, well, a slightly more sophisticated story than the simple diagram can show. And the diagram doesn't show what happens to the other endogenous variables, in particular the money and real interest rates. So that's the effect on the money interest rate. It rises over time by about 1.5%, and the real rate by about 0.5%, before falling back once the shock has ceased. So what we've been doing here is running a simple DSGE model. Recall that that stands for Dynamic Stochastic General Equilibrium. You'll be seeing a lot more of those if you continue with macro next year. The example of a demand shock draws out an important built-in implication of this type of model, which is that any attempt to use fiscal policy to push output above the natural rate is doomed to failure. As inflation will rise without limit. Although there are no grounds for discounting fiscal policy completely, the implication is that it should be limited to offsetting demand shocks. And given what we said earlier about the control problem, in practical terms, this normally means limiting fiscal policy to the automatic stabilizers. Right, so the final major prescription of the new consensus is central bank independence. We can use the model to illustrate the case for this policy, which has been widely adopted. As I mentioned earlier, a supply shock leads to inflation and output moving in different directions, which poses a dilemma for the central bank, which doesn't like either inflation or lower output. And we can show the trade-off in the diagrams as follows. In this first one, the aggregate demand is relatively flat, so that a given inflation shock affects output more than inflation. We can say, if you like, that the bank is hawkish. In the second case, the aggregate demand curve is relatively steep, so that the shock affects inflation more than output. You might say the bank is dovish, I suppose. Now, here's an important point. What the different DAD curves, slopes rather, represent are different preferences. We can draw an indifference curve in to show that the bank chooses the slope of the dynamic aggregate demand curve or the monetary policy rule so that it cuts the aggregate supply curve where the aggregate supply curve touches the indifference curve. Okay. And the indifference curve is drawn around the bliss point where output is at the natural rate and inflation is on target. So that's the centre of the preference surface. Yeah. So in this second case, the trade-off between inflation and output seems balanced as we've got a circle. While in the first case, the hawkish one, the indifference curve is an ellipse. Now the relevance of this to central bank independence is as follows. We start in equilibrium at point A, which is the bliss point. Now, assume that the central bank would like output to be higher than the natural rate at YT. And we assume it's more hawkish on inflation, despite that, by making the indifference curve elliptical. So the BIS point has moved to the right, the intersection of YT and pi star. The central bank will then want to tilt and shift the DAD curve to the right, to DADT, to intersect the point of tangency between the bank's indifference curve and the supply curve. A point B is the bank's preferred combination, the central bank's preferred combination of output and inflation. However, it can only achieve that by cheating, by aiming for a rate of inflation higher than its stated target, which is pi star, of course. We know that the rate of inflation at B is unsustainable, since with output above the natural rate, inflation will continue to rise. So inflation will only stop rising when we reach point C, where the point of tangency of the indifference curve with the new supply curve corresponds to the natural rate of output. Now, at this point, we may assume that the public, informed by economists who have studied the model, no doubt, catches on and works out the central bank's preferences. In particular, they'll recognise that these preferences impart an inflation bias, so that the only sustainable inflation target is pi r, irrespective of any announced target pi star. And pi r is the rational expectation of inflation. And the difference between pi r and pi star is the inflation bias. Now, the moral of the tale is that to avoid the inflation bias, the bank should be protected from political pressure to overheat the economy for political advantage. It's only short-term advantage, of course, but maybe long enough to get re-elected. And that means granting the central bank independence to a greater or lesser degree. In the UK, the compromise since 1997 is that the Bank of England has what's called instrument independence in aiming for an inflation target set by government. The Fed, the US Fed and the ECB have independence in slightly different forms, with the Fed being required by law to aim for a full employment target and the ECB allowed to set its own inflation target. But the practical difference is small once you accept the model. Once you accept the idea that the natural rate of employment means full employment and that output fluctuations are the mathematical dual of inflation fluctuations, then the inflation target is the only thing that matters. So there you have it in simplified form. This is the state of the art in economic policy. What's wrong with it? The first problem is admitted by the new consensus. Mankiw gives it a whole page. It is that the natural rate may not in fact be independent of demand. The term hysteresis is used by analogy with the tendency of electromagnets to stay polarized whichever way they were last. And while logic requires, as we've seen, that it requires the new consensus to deny that demand has any direct long-term effect on employment, the caveat is that high employment may boost capacity and increase the natural rate, while high unemployment destroys people's skills and leads to the premature scrapping of equipment, reducing capacity. And we can just look at that very quickly with the diagram. If we start in our normal place, we have a shock to demand or an increase in demand, and this time the natural rate line is dated. So it started at y bar t minus 1, it's moved to y bar t. As output increases, or while output is above the natural rate rises. So you can quickly reach a position there at a higher rate of inflation than normally than before, but also a higher natural rate of output than before. The policy implication of that is that steady upward pressure on demand may actually raise the natural rate, and it becomes all the more important to stabilise and to avoid large and sudden shifts in output. A sudden increase may lead simply to inflation without much output, a sudden decrease in output to unemployment and loss of capacity without much impact on inflation. Beyond hysteresis, the deeper criticism is at the foundation of the whole model, as with earlier forms of monetarism, is the concept of the natural rate, interpreted as full employment. We've seen that logically all the models require is a neru, a sociological relationship between money wages and unemployment. And what that means is that inflation targeting is a substitute for an incomes policy, an elaborate exercise in the management of wage expectations, backed up ultimately by the threat of unemployment. And it seems, since incomes policy and other things have been tried, that our political system will allow nothing better. So on that cheerful note, next time I'm going to examine the proposition that business cycles are caused simply by external shocks to an otherwise stable, self-adjusting system, by considering the origins of the financial crises in the North Atlantic and the Eurozone.